Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. I usually have just one topic that I want to focus on. And, you know, basically we tell the story of how an entrepreneur built his business and spend some time on the one thing that makes the person unique. Today's guest, I've got a few things that I want to talk about that make him unique. Number one, he's an entrepreneur who's building a consulting agency. You know, they do development of web apps and mobile apps and more. But he's catering to startups. Not startups who just raise funding, whose VCs are going to introduce them to him, to startups who have no freaking funding. How's he building a business like that and staying profitable? Number one. Number two, he was homeless at one point in his life, and I like to pry into people's personal lives with their permission. So I'm going to ask him about what that was like and how it influenced the way that he thinks about money and business today. So we'll have a little bit of heart in this interview, just a little bit. Mostly I'll talk about the business part of that. It's funny, by the way, Jake, what I do is I ask people about their personal stuff and I get a little emotionally invested in it. But for the most part, all I want to do is suck out, like, how did that shape you as an entrepreneur, Jake? So I'll do that in this interview. And then the final thing, this is my personal obsession, but frankly, any entrepreneur needs to take this on as an obsession. How does he systemize his business? He told me last week when we tried to record this interview and we had some tech issues, that the reason that he's able to service so many entrepreneurs who have, frankly, very little money to spend, how can he service them in a predictable, strong way and still make money? And he said it's systems. So I want to understand how he systemizes his business. All right, those are the three things: systemizing his business, his background and personal background, and then I also want to find out how he works with entrepreneurs. This whole thing is sponsored by two great companies. The first will allow you to buy a design, and I'll talk to you about a logo that I hired from that I bought from them. It's called Design Crowd. And the second is a company that I've used to get somebody to come in here as like a part-time CFO. I can't wait to tell you what happened with that. I just had my first meeting with the person. Anyway, I hired him through Top Tal. I'll tell you guys about both those later. Jake, good to have you here.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks, Andrew.
You know, while you're still smiling and we're still friends, let me ask you the toughest question about revenue. How much revenue are you guys producing here?
So right now we're at a monthly recurring revenue of about $150,000 a month.
$150,000, and I should say the company is LaunchPeer. You have a team of 27 people. You build web apps, you build mobile apps, and you also do growth for new startups, right?
Right, yeah. So we've been around for 3 years. Our primary focus is on pre-seed stage or pre-angel investment startups. And so we'll get into how exactly we do that, because I know a lot of
focus
people
focus on people who don't have money. It's like you're basically saying, I'm going to turn people away if they have a Series A funding.
Right. And we don't do that, but we've a lot of people have asked us about that for sure.
Are you profitable?
Yeah, definitely. So everything about LaunchPeer is bootstrapped. I started the company 3 years ago. Me and my wife are co-founders. And all the money that goes into the business goes straight. Like, it's all business funding. We're not raising money from venture capital. We're not using somebody else's money. So the reason we have such good systems in place is because we have to have good systems in place. We don't have a choice.
I'm looking at my notes from my producer's conversation with you, and one thing that stands out is I have PTSD when it comes to spending money. And the reason that you're so lean, the reason that you care so much about where every dollar goes, is this background that I hinted at earlier. Were you literally homeless?
Yeah, literally homeless. For a couple years in high school, we were homeless. And I came from a really low-income family. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom did drugs. And so we always bounced back between the two. And in high school,
you look so straight edge that honestly, like, I'm a dark person. I always look at someone like you and I think he's got every advantage. He looks good. He looks even the way that you're dressed makes you look like you grew up in this environment where I imagine that your hardest decision in life was which country club to go to on Sunday. That's not it at all.
No, not at all, actually. And if you look at the way I dress, it's definitely because of my wife, for sure. but when we went back, being raised homeless and poor, I think a lot of entrepreneurs go through really tough times. And the thing is, how are you going to get yourself out of it? And
set the stage for me. When you say your dad was an alcoholic, do you mean every night he would have a beer or two beers? Your mother, tell me, like, give me an example of how bad it was for you.
So it was bad enough to where every night our dad would kind of lock us in our room after like 7:38, and then he would drink. So he did as much as he could to kind of hide it from me and my little sister. She's 2 years younger than me. But I remember back when I was, you know, from 7 to 16 years old, you know, coming out of the room at night and him throwing up and, you know, seeing empty beer bottles and stuff. And so it wasn't, he tried to hide it from us. But when you're a kid and you're raised in, it was a one bedroom condo, me and my wife shared, or me and my sister shared a room for our whole lives, basically. You know, it's hard to hide something in such a small space. So my dad did as much as he could, but it wasn't easy for him to hide it from us.
Meanwhile, when they got a divorce, your dad got custody, not your mom, which tells me that that must have been even worse. What was going on with your mom?
So my mom was doing drugs, more harder drugs. I think it was meth, but she doesn't like to talk about it, which is completely understandable. And so I think when it came time to, you know, we were switching custody back and forth. I remember going, and my mom did a much better job of hiding it from us, mostly because she didn't have full custody of us at any point until I got into high school after my dad passed away when I was 16. But before that, she mostly did it on the weekends when we weren't there because my dad was keeping us during the week for the most part. And so he was hiding it from us at night. She was hiding it from us during the week. And then when we came over to her on the weekend, it was like everything was great. We only really found out about this is because we started getting pulled into court for custody hearings. And obviously kids sometimes take part in that. And when people start asking you tough questions, you kind of have to wake up to the reality that, one, your parents aren't perfect, and two, they're far from it. And three, like, this isn't normal. Like the life that we're living in, when you're a kid, you think all this stuff is normal. Everyone goes through this. Until you start talking to your friends, or you do start making friends with people who are a lot more straight edge, and their parents do go to the country club every weekend.
You know what? The reason I thought, for many reasons, I wasn't normal, but one of them was that I would watch The Cosby Show, and The Cosby Show, as like wholesome and good as it is, yeah, it really sets up families for failure, because you look at your family compared to them and you go, what the hell's wrong with you, Dad?
Yeah. And for us, it was, for me, it was Full House. I remember watching that and thinking, oh, well, that's how a family should be. But my family's not that different from it, right? I mean, I have a little sister and we have fun, and I have an older sister. And yeah, I don't see my mom and dad all the time, but we have a lot of friends' families who are divorced. You know, I didn't realize it until I got into high school and had to start wearing the same clothes to school every day, and we didn't have a home to come to. And that's when it started really sinking in.
And the reason you didn't have a home was?
So my dad lost his job when I was about 15 or 16. And so because of that, We didn't have any money. We were really low income. So it's not like he had savings or we had a big family to go to. So we just started living out of our car. So I remember we'd get to school at, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. And then he'd pick us up at about 5 or 6 o'clock at the end of the day. We'd drive around for a couple hours because he had an extra key to the place he used to work, which was a big factory warehouse. And so we'd drive around until everyone had left, and then we'd sneak in. And that's where we'd wash up, you know, in the sink there at the workplace. And he'd park his car in there, and we'd sit there until really early in the morning when he knew not everybody was there at work, and then he'd leave. So it was kind of living like a second life, sort of.
And at that point, you must have known something is wrong. How do you put up with that level of discomfort without complaining to your dad, getting angry at your dad? What was it that allowed you to deal with this?
So I do remember getting angry with my dad, but I think it was less anger and more motivation. Like, I realized that, hey, I'm 16 now. I have 2 years until I finish high school. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that this is not my life. Because when I started looking back at my family history, he wasn't the only one. And my mom wasn't the only one. Our whole family for generations had, you know, I was the first one who actually ended up graduating high school, first one to go to college, and a bunch of other firsts. And when you start thinking about it when you're 15 or 16, there's very little you can do about it. And so I started focusing on not what I couldn't do about it, but what I could do about it over the next 2 years. And so it really helped my work ethic and really helped me learn how to become a hustler, which goes into all the entrepreneurial stuff I ended up doing.
I see. You know what? I jumped into this interview. I don't think I properly introduced you as Jake Hare. Jake. And so you said, because I'm fascinated by you, not just your story, which we're getting into right now, but also the way that you operate and all the research that I've done. I told you last week I got sucked into your world as I was researching you. So I jumped in a little too fast into this interview. So Jake, you're saying, I had to find a better way. So many entrepreneurs email me and say, I didn't realize this existed, this world of entrepreneurship, that this was an option until Mixergy. or until something else happened. What was it for you that let you know this is an option? My parents have one life, but here's this other crazy thing that's completely different that's for me being a business person.
So when I was growing up, I was always sort of a hustler, not because I really wanted to be or I even knew what entrepreneurship was, but because I needed lunch money. So what I would do is I'd figure out ways to just make lunch money on the side. So I remember betting on Monday night football games with my friends. I remember trading Pokemon cards for cash. I remember, I was really good at drawing when I was a kid. So I'd sell like little drawings to my friends for $1 or $2 here or there. But I didn't know that was entrepreneurship. That was like the farthest thing from my mind. After graduating college, which I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. So when you're growing up and you're watching Full House and you're watching Law and Order and all these other shows, you start thinking, especially as a kid with unsuccessful, you know, from a household like that, you start looking for outside influences to figure out what you want in life. And so I thought, okay, well, lawyers look successful and doctors look successful. I don't want to be a doctor, so I'm going to go try to be a lawyer. So I went to college thinking I was going to be a lawyer, graduated college, had a really good GPA, and then I didn't really get introduced to entrepreneurship as a career until after I graduated college. I was in the Army for a few years, and then during the Army, I started learning about tech. And if you're in tech, you're going to stumble across entrepreneurship at some point. So that's what happened.
Okay, so it wasn't so much, hey, 16-year-old Jake Hare is sitting in the car saying, one day I'll be an entrepreneur and get myself out of here by making money. One day I'll find a way out of here. Probably the law is going to be my way out because it's Law and Order and other TV shows are telling me lawyers can dress up in suits and don't have to wear the same thing every day, but who knows? And so you kept working. I see you then were thinking about law school. You actually got accepted. You said, I don't want the student debt that goes along with it. And frankly, it seems like that wasn't in your makeup of who you were, that you would have taken on that debt if you felt like the law was right for you. Am I right in reading that, or am I being too much armchair quarterbacking here?
Oh, no, definitely. I was about to graduate college, got accepted into a few law schools, Duke, Columbia, and a couple others. But if you look at those law schools, you can't work while you're going to law school. They don't allow you to do that. And during college, I was working a 40-hour job doing construction and going to school full time. That's how I was able to pay for school. But after that, I was like, well, how am I going to pay for law school? I can't work, and I have a kid on the way, and I'm married. So why don't I just join the Army instead? And every time that I hit a roadblock growing up, instead of thinking like, oh man, like this, that's it, it's over, like I can't move beyond this, I always thought, well, what's a way to go around that? How can I get over that hurdle? And so for me, it was joining the Army. The Army would pay for law school for me if I wanted to do that after. So I ended up enlisting in the Army in, I think it was 2010, I ended up joining the Army.
What's the tech that you got into in the Army?
So I was an intelligence analyst. And so, you know, a lot of cybersecurity stuff, a lot of networking and computer systems. That was really our primary job. I know intelligence work, people think of like CIA stuff and spy thrillers, and it's the farthest thing from that. A lot of times in the Army, they called my position like PowerPoint Rangers because we were just incredibly good at like creating PowerPoint presentations. But we were good at other stuff too. So
how did it teach you something that translates into building websites or mobile apps, which is what you're doing right now with LaunchPeer?
Yeah, so I think the Army really made me straight edge. It made me really good at speaking because we had to brief generals, we had to brief majors and command staff. A lot of times they're twice as old as you, and they don't really care what background you're from. They don't care who you are. They don't even really care what your name is. They just want to know what's the information you're going to give me and how does that pertain to the problem we're trying to deal with. And so it taught me a lot about how to deal with people that are, more important than me, like quote unquote more important than me. And so when I got out, it was really easy for me to present myself in a way that hiring managers wanted to see. And so I didn't get a job in tech as a developer. I got a job in tech as a business analyst whose job really is to translate between a development team and a client. And so that's what made me really good at working with startups, because a lot of times startups don't really know what they want. And so it's my job to kind of translate what they want to a developer in as lean a way as possible.
I see. So Jake, what you're telling me is the military didn't train you to code. The military trained you to speak and work with people. And that's what allowed you then to work with developers and others. I see. You know what? So John Lee Dumas runs a podcast called EO Fire, and he invited me out. You know him, right?
Yeah.
So he invited me to do this podcast cruise with him, where I got to see him on a cruise with a bunch of, I don't know how many hundreds of people, dozens of people, of fans of his. Some people were really annoying and really demanding and a little complainy. And I looked at his face the whole time and I said, I don't see anything about you that shows that you're at all disturbed by this. Why aren't you disturbed by some of these things that are coming to you? Just always so calm. And he said, you know, I was in the military. I forget what branch he was in. There's stuff that goes wrong there all the time. If you think that this little thing is going to bother me, you're out of your mind. This is peanuts compared to what you, right? And so was the same thing for you? Were you also shaped that way?
Yeah, definitely. I remember one experience specifically when I was in the military. We had our command staff ask us to go paint like serial numbers on our Humvees and vehicles and stuff. The problem was it was downpouring outside. So it was kind of weird, like, oh, go paint the vehicles outdoors. And they knew they were just doing it to mess with us. But those are kind of the frustrating things that you deal with, or picking up rocks or like cutting grass when it's already cut and a bunch of these other things. And then let alone like the actual frustration of war fighting and all that. When you deal with something like that for 3 or 4 years, you know, the complaining from people in civilian life, it's not like it doesn't mean anything, but when you start dealing with fires and you start dealing with people complaining, or you start having trouble with some clients like we have now sometimes, or they get frustrated with something, it's really easy because of that experience to put things in a normal perspective, to start looking at it and thinking, you know, this isn't the end of the world. What can I do to fix this? And so I know John has that same mentality. And so I think that mentality was kind of grown in me too through all those experiences I had in the military.
Okay, so you then left the military, you got a job, as you talked about, what was it called, the business analyst?
Business analyst,
yeah. Business analyst, and then you came up with this idea that you wanted to do something on the side, and you went to talk to them. We'll take a moment here, and then we're going to jump back into the story of how Jake created LaunchPeer. But first, I got to tell you and everyone else about my sponsor, which is Design Crowd. I have a designer, Jake. I know you have tons of designers on your team. I have a designer who I've really been loving. He's creating these phenomenal landing pages for us that actually convert, sales pages now he's starting to work on. He's doing a lot of stuff. So then you might be wondering, why would I, with this designer and access to so many other designers, why would I go to a site like Design Crowd? And the reason is this. We had this need for a logo for our graduates, something that showed that they were certified bot creators. I've got this bot business too. I didn't want one great designer's idea of it. I wanted some options. And so what I did was, someone one of our graduates gave me a list of all the certified logos that she liked. I said, this is phenomenal. I'm going to go to Design Crowd, upload this image with all those designs that she likes, because she's the one who's going to have to put our certified logo on her site, and people like her are going to have to do it. I'll take all of the ones that she likes, I'll put it on their site, and I'll tell them, I'm looking for this type of logo. I want these words on it. I want this kind of design. Boom, 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 boom. And then I got, I think it was 192 different designs. Let me go in and take a look. Which is at first really overwhelming. But you know what? What they have on Design Crowd is, it's an easy way for me to click and say, no, I don't like this. I don't like that. I don't like that. Keep giving them feedback. The hardest part of this process is giving people feedback, because I'm a nice person and I keep going in and saying, I like this, but I think you need to do this. I like that, but I think you need to do this. Right. And then Kelly, who gave me her design suggestions, asked for my username and password so she could see how I'm responding to people. And she said, Andrew, be a little more freaking straightforward. So I was. I went in and she was more straightforward. I was more straightforward. And suddenly all the designs took in my feedback and her feedback, and they all improved. And by the end of this process, I got the number now, 191 people submitted their designs. We picked the one that we like, a badge that I'd feel proud of, and the badge that she and others would feel proud to put on their site. And we paid for just that one. That's the beauty of Design Crowd. You tell them what you're looking for. You tell them in words or in images that you see that you like online. And then they get it out to their army of designers and they say, go do it. And you as the client get to give feedback, and you only pay for the one that you like. And you can do this for so many different design projects. Anytime that you have one, I know ebooks are really big on this. I know we used it for the cover art for this podcast. All right, if you're into this, it is something that's worked so well for the Mixergy community that Design Crowd keeps buying more ads. Here's the URL that they created just for us to give you, the Mixergy listener, up to $100 off. Go to designcrowd.com/Mixergy, designcrowd.com/Mixergy. You'll see right on there the image that I, one of the images that I bought from them, and you can see some of the work that they've done for other people. I really am so excited to be working with them, and I know that you're going to get good results from them. designcrowd.com/Mixergy. Let the crowd help you get your next great design. All right. You then go to your agency, Jake?
Yep. So the first thing I did was I started a couple SaaS startups before I even thought of the idea for LaunchPeer, which is where the idea for LaunchPeer was. So I tried to build a property management application. That didn't go so well, mostly because I'm non-technical. So back then, I didn't know the difference between Java and JavaScript and all these other things like HTML. I had no idea what it was. But like any good entrepreneur, I started trying to learn all this stuff. And what I started realizing was it is really freaking hard to find a good one, good tech co-founder, but let alone trying to find a good freelancer. Because if you're non-technical, it's hard to figure out like, well, what should I look for? What kind of equity should I give away? Should I pay them to do it? Should I not? How much is a good rate? All these things. And so that kind of fizzled out. And then I tried to start another app and that didn't go. That fizzled out.
Because you weren't able to find people to develop it for you?
Right, because it was just really hard to find. And I worked in an agency. So the agency I worked at, we did software development. We did app development. And the problem was that agency, like a lot of others, is set up to work with big clients. We were working with Coca-Cola. We were working with Department of Veteran Affairs. We were working with big brands. The problem was the processes that those brands really like do not work for entrepreneurs. Like, they don't have upfront pricing or transparent pricing. They don't have a short sales cycle. They don't have like scale up and down based on where you are, whether you're MVP or whether you're post-launch. Like, they want to be able to put a team of 5 developers full time on your project for a few months and then churn something out. Well, 5 developers full time for 5 months is a lot of money. Most early stage startups can't afford that. And I remember going to the agency I was working at and saying, hey, I want to build this. You know, this is all the requirements. And I was a requirements analyst and business analyst. So I had it all buttoned up. I knew exactly what I wanted or what I thought I wanted. And they said, cool, to build this, it's going to be $1.2 million. And I was like, great. There's no way I can afford that. That's when I started getting the idea that, hey, maybe there's an idea for building an agency that only caters to early stage startups. And so I started going around the community and doing some validation and talking to friends and going to startup groups and meetups in town and started kind of pitching them on this idea of like, oh yeah, I want to build this agency just for startups. And everyone really loved the idea. The one question I kept getting was, well, startups don't have any money, so how are you going to make money? And yeah. I know we're going to get to that in a minute, but that's kind of where the idea for LaunchPeer was born. And I started LaunchPeer while I was working at that other agency with permission from the agency, like, hey, I want to start this thing. And they said, yeah, that's fine. As long as you just focus on startups, go ahead and do it. So for
were
about
you focused on startups in the beginning, because I'm looking at Internet Archive. Actually, I'm bringing it up right now. Internet yeah. Archive shows that you weren't focused on startups in the beginning, that you had right. more of a generalist, at least messaging in the beginning.
Yeah. And that's the biggest mistake that we made. So for about 6 months, we got a couple projects. And I remember the day that I quit that job, we got one big project. I think it was, and for big, it was like $20,000. So I said, okay, this is it. Like, this is validation right here. So me and my wife are going to quit. We had one or two contractors that we were working with at the time, and we're just going to take off. And so we started building this app, started focusing on trying to build that. And then we did what a lot of agencies do, which was we didn't focus on sales. And we got to the end of that project and said, oh, there's no more sales in our pipeline. I thought if we just built something, people would come and start using it, or people would fill out the contact form on our site. And so instead of taking the attitude of maybe there's something we're doing wrong, we took the attitude of maybe startups just don't have money. So let's generalize. Let's do what all the other agencies do and just say, we build cool stuff for cool people.
I see. So first you started out by going after startups. You got a client. Right. Then when you tried to get other startups and couldn't, you said, let's go broader. I see.
Right.
How'd you get that first client? Yeah. 20,000 is a good amount.
Yeah, it is a good amount. It was going to a networking event and finding someone who needed to find a tech co-founder.
Which one?
So they were called Renteater at the time. Renteater. So they were very similar to the startup that I was trying to build before. So it was really easy to build rapport with them, and doing it in person was really easy because I was able to convince them, like, look, we're a young agency, but you know, this is how we do things a little bit differently. And that really sold him on the idea. Once we started working with them, everything went great. The problem was it wasn't the startups that were the problem. It was our sales process and marketing process that was the problem. Just like I'm not a developer, I also wasn't a marketer or salesperson either. So I had no idea how to go get new
clients. But what you were doing was saying, you know what, I'll be the in-between because that's what I do in my day job anyway. Right. I'll go online, I'll find the developers for each project, and I'll keep being the in-between, the guy who manages the developers, brings it back to the client, takes the client's information, and goes back to the developers. That was the model.
Right. And so I was like the in-between communication to make sure that they were getting built what actually needed to get built.
So then why did that take up so much of your time that you couldn't look for other clients? That doesn't seem like that's that much. It's just going back and forth.
So startups are very they want a lot of attention, especially when they're early on and they're still trying to figure out what product they want. So it's not like when I was working at the other agencies, you know, Coca-Cola and the Department of Veteran Affairs would come to us with like 400 page requirements documents. They knew exactly what they wanted. They had all the mock-ups ready, and all they'd do was drop it on the table and say, all right, just build this. Like, how long is it going to take? 6 months.
Because there's so much to figure out.
Right. And so with startups, it was every day like, hey, Jake, what do you think about building this? Or maybe we should do this feature instead. Or maybe we should change the color of this button or move it over to this side and all this other stuff. And which is fine. The problem is when you start getting invested in the startup, you start wanting to work on it as much as the founders do. And you start forgetting that, hey, my whole business is centered around making more sales and doing marketing, which we just stopped doing for a little bit too long.
You know what? I'm smiling because your sites have come up on my screen. Oh, there it is. I'm getting all these alerts as I'm pulling up pages about you as you're talking. So one of the first versions of your site says LaunchPeer in big, clear words, and then also very concrete what you do and who you serve, software development and consulting for startups and small business. This is the beginning.
Right. Beginning.
Let me see what date this is. This is what your site looked like on October 2014. Now skip to October 2015. Here is the industries we serve: startups and entrepreneurs, healthcare tech companies, government. All right. Yeah. So those are the ones that you service. And it actually goes into more detail, like Department of Veterans, DOD, et cetera. And then what we do goes on for a bit from there, and then on and on and on and on. I don't know what MOASC web redesign is, but that's something you guys do.
Yeah.
It just goes on and on. I see.
Yeah. That year, between, I think 2015 was our toughest year by far. 2015 and then halfway into 2016, we just completely lost our way completely.
And you'd given up your job.
We had given up our job.
And it's you and your wife working on it.
Yep. And my wife had to go back to work. This was early 2015. She had to go back to work. I was staying at home watching our 3-year-old son at the time. So I was a stay-at-home dad. I remember taking sales calls, because yes, we were getting some sales calls. I remember taking sales calls and having to walk outside and telling my 3-year-old, just sit here and watch SpongeBob. I have a sales call, so please don't come and bug me or say anything.
Yeah, I'm sure that worked.
Oh, yeah, that never worked.
But it was sometimes. Dad said I should sit here. Of course, I'll sit here.
Sometimes it was a cute thing when they'd come on, but sometimes it wasn't such a cute thing.
Especially now when someone's trying to work with you.
And so we just completely lost our way for about a year and a half. And when things started changing is when we got back to what
Before we get into things changing, I want to I got to have some heart in this interview, but also to touch back on where you were, which is suddenly you can't pay the bills.
Right.
The heating bill wasn't getting paid. And as a result, what happened with your son?
Yeah. So, you know, we got to the point where we missed mortgage payments. I think we missed 2 or 3. So my credit is not that great.
To this day, if I pull credit report on you, it's not good.
Oh yeah. It'll be like low 600s, high 500s probably.
Wow, okay.
So pretty bad. So, you know, we missed mortgage payments, it was a lot of robbing Peter to pay Paul. Like, okay, well, I won't pay the mortgage payment, but I'll pay all the electric bill payments and stuff. And then I'll switch over and, oh, there's this client payment that might come in a couple of weeks and I can pay our, you know, heating bill. And it was just going back and forth. And I remember there was 3 times where we missed our electric bill payment, which meant our air got shut off in Middle Tennessee. In the summer, it gets in the upper 90s, probably low 100s. And, you know, that is really tough when you have, you know, a 5-year-old and 3-year-old. And I remember coming home one day and the air conditioner had got shut off, the electric was shut off, and it was the weekend, so it was almost impossible to get a hold of someone to pay the bill. We didn't really have the money in the account to pay it. And so I remember my son started crying and saying, like, oh, are we going to be poor? And I thought, you know, like, that's it. Like, I can't do this anymore. You know, I can't keep doing this, especially since I was making almost six figures at the job I was at before, and I was only 26 years old. And you're 26.
Why did you do that? You're a guy who said at 16, I'm never going to let my life be like this. And here you were spiraling down, maybe not to living in your car, but not to living, you know, the life that you aspire to.
Right.
10 years after you'd set out on this path, why didn't you say, entrepreneurship is not for me. I had a good six-figure job. Let's go get that job and make sure that I'm never going to do to my kids what my dad did to me and my sister.
I mean, I had the bug. I mean, I had the entrepreneur bug. Yeah, the bug. I mean, I think a lot of entrepreneurs get it where they just start convincing themselves that I'm going to make this work. But actually, I did give up. I remember it was early 2016. I think it was like March or April. I gave up. I started applying to other jobs. I started looking for work. I got a couple callbacks. At the same time that I had given up, though, I was so desperate. I decided, you know what? If I'm going to fail, I'm going to fail hard. And so I'm going to go back and try to start the business that I wanted to start. Like, let's go back to what we originally said we were going to do and build an agency just for startups. So literally with one tab open for Indeed.com and another tab open for our website, I was editing our website copy and messaging while I was sending applications out for jobs. And I thought, well, one of them is going to break, right? I'm either going to get a job or somehow, some way, I'm going to start getting customers because we pivoted back to what we were actually supposed to be in the first place.
Going right back to the startups that you wanted to get.
Yeah. And it's funny, if you go back to the web archives, I'm sure you can see it. Like, number one, we only focus on startups. And then for a year, our website probably changed 30 times. And we focused on everybody. And then I think probably in April or May of 2016, we went back, we rebranded. So we didn't have the clip art logo that we had before. We got a new logo, new color scheme, kept the name, but really focused on startups. And that's when everything really started to change for us, was at that point. So luckily I didn't get a job before we got some more customers.
So April 2016, I'm going to pull it up and see if I could find what the site looks like. Archive.org is really useful for things like this.
Oh,
it's just a little slow for fast research.
Yeah.
There. Okay. Now suddenly I see like Mission Control in Houston for the space shuttle is what the backdrop image is. And the headline is just Startup on Demand.
Yep.
Developers, designers, and growth hackers on tap to build and grow your startup. That is the focus. Curated services, money-back guarantee, only the top 5%, upfront pricing, pre-packaged service, handcrafted experts. This is everything that you are doing today in a really simple, easy-to-understand, focused message. That's the difference.
Huge difference. I mean, that made all the difference for us. I remember when we made that pivot and went back to what we wanted to be, like, call started coming in. I mean, and it's not like we were doing any like big marketing spend because I literally had no money. We had gone from making that money and having hardly anything in savings when we started the business. I think we had maybe $15,000 or $20,000 in savings, and it wasn't really even savings. It was just sitting there. And we spent all of it, went into another $30,000 in debt from credit cards and a bunch of stuff. So we had no more money to spend. And so it's not like we were spending a bunch on Facebook ads and all that stuff. It was just a messaging change. It was getting
back. How do people know about you? How did they even come to see this really nicely designed site?
So at that time, I was doing things that just wouldn't scale today. I started going to a ton of networking events, started going to meetups, started cold calling people, cold emailing people, like going on AngelList and finding startups that had just recently listed their profile. And just started reaching out and saying, look, this is the service we have. This is what we do. Like, do you need anything? And that's when we started picking up steam. That wouldn't have worked 6 months earlier. It wouldn't have worked if they went to our website and saw that we just do everything for everyone. That message doesn't speak to a good customer.
All right, be honest with me. How did you get these people? On your site, you have a talent spotlight. It looks constantly like you had so many people on staff, even though you're telling me you had nothing but a phone and not even heating or air conditioning. How did you get Lucas J, funding expert, over $5 million raised? He's one of the talented people who are working at the time at LaunchPeer. Sarah H, marketing expert. Michael G, iOS developer. How'd you get all these people? Be open.
So I went to my network and started telling people, basically begging people, like, hey, look, I'm going to bring you work. Like, you want to work with startups. And I already knew these people wanted to work with startups based on their profile or the LinkedIn profile, and started reaching out and saying, look, I'm redoing my whole business. Like, I'm shifting everything. I was basically starting from scratch and just saying, look, I made a bunch of mistakes the last year and a half, but this is what LaunchPeer is and this is what we want it to be. I want you to come on board. You don't have to have any buy-in. All I want to do is put your face on our website, and I want you to be available if we do sign any startups in order for us to have them work with you. And you'll get paid for it. It's not like we won't pay you, but I just want to make sure that our network is open and available for any startups that could hopefully come to LaunchPeer and want to build something. And that's how it happened.
I see. So they were just on the site. If you got a client, they would work with the client if they're a good fit. Got it. Okay.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, even like suddenly the lead magnet on the site changes and is clear. It's 230 awesome resources for startups. Press one button to download it. And before you download, we ask for your email address.
I didn't even know what a lead magnet was before that.
This is, and you know what? Here's how new you were at all this. It was, it was like the branding of the tool that you were using, which is LeadIn, is still on the button.
Right? Yeah, it is.
And you're still using a lot of stuff. You and I talked before the interview started about how you're using ManyChat for chatbots. I guess if you're going to do growth hacking or growth for your clients, you should be doing it for yourself. You also used, what's the other one? Proof.
Yep. We have Proof on our site.
How's Proof
working
for you?
So Proof works great for us. We have a lot of landing pages now that I actually know what a lead magnet is. We have a lot of lead magnets that we have. We use Viper.io for our giveaways. We have tens of thousands of people on our email list now. And ManyChat has been great for us. We have a few hundred subscribers to ManyChat. It's really been like a full, like complete 180 from what it was before to what it is now. And I think one thing that founders need to do when they're early on is you're going to make a lot of mistakes the first year and a half, the first year, first 6 months, however it is, right? Especially if you're a bootstrapped founder who doesn't have access to a VC who's worked with dozens of startups before and just kind of knows the ropes. If you're bootstrapping, you're going to have to figure a lot of this stuff out on the way to hopeful success. Or if you fail, going on to the next thing and building something else that's successful. But we learned a lot of lessons on the way, especially me, and having a small team and knowing that if I don't make money, my family's not going to be able to pay the bills. Like, that is such a powerful thing for an entrepreneur to know. And it forces you to break yourself out of, well, I'm just going to do it because I think it's going to work. And when we started being successful is when we got away from that and started thinking, I need to switch things up and start doing what I think needs to be done because I want to make our customers successful. And once we started thinking that way, a lot of things started changing for us.
You know what? Part of this is what scared me off of doing an interview with you. Like, you have really dialed in landing pages. The landing pages are all offering books and guides for startups. I said, this is the guy who's really good at marketing. There's no way he's running a real agency catering to startups. There's no way this works. So what he's probably doing is talking to himself, trying to figure out what it is that he needs, writing it down and offering it to others as lead magnet. But no, I see the model now. All right. I want to figure out how you're making it work for, entrepreneurs who don't have much money. That includes the system. Now I understand the focus. Let's talk about the system, how it looks to the client and also what you do on the back end that works. And then also it looks like you have a new book, which I see on your Twitter profile. Another reason why I was afraid to do an interview with you. Even your Twitter profile is dialed in.
Yeah.
The one mistake you have, and I don't want to embarrass you, but since I'm like complimenting you a lot, I think it'll be fine. Your personal website expired on Squarespace.
No, I'll fix that.
Go get it before somebody else gets it.
Yeah, I know. Seriously. The domain name's still good. I had to pay a lot of money for that domain name.
What'd you have to pay for it?
I had to pay $3,500 for it. Wow. You know what the funny thing is? Before I started the business, it was $10. And I thought, I don't need to buy my personal website. Like, you know, I'm not going to use it. I'll just focus on LaunchPeer. And then 2 years go by. And then I say, you know what? I should buy my personal website. And then I go and look at it. And it had got bought by hugedomains.com. And I had to basically like pay $3,500 for it. I'm just leasing it. So I have a payment plan to buy my domain name.
You're paying to get it, to own it.
Right.
It's like it's like on layaway.
Yeah, exactly. It's just layaway.
You don't have $3,500, you just give it to them and get rid of them?
I probably should do that. I think I could offer them a low amount and do it. But when I had got the domain name, it was like 6 months ago or something, and you know, I'm still pretty cheap. And I was like, well, should I drop $3,500 to buy it, or should I just pay like $200 for the next couple of years and just have it available? So that's kind of what I did.
So you got it, and then here I am telling you the site is down.
I know. Yeah.
Who's Brad Hare?
I don't know.
Ah, that's who you have as your administrative contact on, or maybe that's who they, the owners of the domain, have as their administrative contact. Constantly smart, searching baby. As we're doing these interviews. By the way, speaking of Squarespace, one quick tip that I learned about Squarespace: if you're ever on a Squarespace site, hit escape. In fact, if you're ever curious if something's in a Squarespace site, hit escape, right? Because doesn't escape take you directly to the
Squarespace.com?
Squarespace, any domain that's hosted on Squarespace, if you hit escape, you know it's hosted on Squarespace, because that's what takes you into the login screen or whatever, the dashboard.
Ah, got it. That's a good trick. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, as a customer of theirs, now you'll be able to use that every time you want to log into your own site.
Yeah, we manage a lot of sites on Squarespace. So
you do, huh?
We're big fans. Oh, yeah,
beautiful. Huge. There, I just taught you something you'll be able to use. I think it should still work, isn't it? Yeah, anyway, it should work. We should. There we go. No, I can't test it. I hate when I can't test it. Guys, somebody please test it and confirm it. All right, first, I've got to go on and talk about my sponsor, a company called TopTal. Get this. Jake, you might be going through this, but you might be at a point where you're too cheap to want to do it. Here's my problem. Years ago, I had a company which did online greeting cards, did a lot of profits, a lot of revenues, and then I had a down year. And man, because I had a down year, I was bummed about myself. We lost money. Only losers lose money. I had this height. How did I suddenly lose money? And it wasn't like the end of the world, but I lost money. In my head, I thought, I'm a failure. I have to find a way to get myself out of it. But I had a great CFO, chief financial officer, a guy who would go through my finances, and he didn't have this like self-criticism over the books. He just needed to look at the books. And so he looked at the books and he said, you know, Andrew, we are having an off year here. I could see the problem. I know that we're fixing it for next year, but you know, you can actually get back some of the money you paid in taxes last year. I said, what? He goes, well, here's how it works. And he started telling me how it works. I go, oh, I'm so busy thinking that I failed here, and this is a guy who just is thinking. So I followed his instructions. I did exactly what I was supposed to. I took it to my accountants. I said, what the hell did you guys not – why didn't you guys know about this? They said, well, we didn't think about it. We weren't looking at it, I guess, that carefully. It's so good that you've got this guy, Richard Erb, on your team. Great. It is so good. And sure enough, we got some money back. And there were lots of situations like that where I was thinking like the business person. How do I bring in more money? Or I was thinking with my own worldview, with my own personal experiences – and the CFO was thinking broader. Here's my experience from all these other companies. Here's what I know, and here's what I could bring in, because I, unlike Andrew, the founder, am not in my own head about like success and failure. What does this mean? And what's the day-to-day activities? So that's years ago. What does that have to do with Mixergy and this other company, Bot Academy, that we're running? Here's the difference. Now I'm running the whole thing by myself. It's me and the bookkeepers who are looking at the numbers. Sometimes I'm just repeating the same stuff over and over without recognizing that I'm doing it. Like, I had these assumptions. Well, I'll talk about them in a second. Anyway, I went to TopTal. I said, hey, you guys are TopTal. You bought a company that does nothing but hire out finance people. I want to work with one of your people. So they gave me three candidates. I talked to all three. There was one guy who had like five businesses that he ran, and he could help me in certain ways. Another woman who was fresh out of Stanford, fantastic but not perfect. And then a final person who I hired, a guy who was a McKinsey person, who ran companies, who did all this, had all this experience. I talked to him. I showed him my books on the screen. I gave him limited access after the call. And then I hired him because I loved that he immediately was giving me feedback. I immediately was like taking control of my mouse and keyboard using our screen share. Do you recognize any of this, by the way, Jake? Does this resonate as an entrepreneur?
Oh, yeah. We should have hired an accountant way before we actually did last year.
I've had an accountant. I've had him for years. But even the accountant's bringing the same thing. What the accountant has is an interest in covering your ass and their ass, but they're not looking for new ways for you to make money. Nobody says, this accountant helped me restructure the way that I'm paying my credit card or the way that I'm charging on credit cards. Anyway, he looked at my whole thing. We were supposed to start Monday, October 23rd. The weekend before I give him all this access, he's already giving me a document, a spreadsheet showing me why we should be an S Corp, not an LLC. Why didn't he think about it? Giving me numbers. He hasn't even been hired. He's not getting paid. He can't help himself. He gives me a worksheet with his main objectives, his secondary objectives, and a detailed list of how he's going to achieve those objectives. the hell is this guy? We get on the phone on Monday. We talk a little bit further. And he's saying, you know what, Andrew, with these refunds, you're paying twice possibly. I go, I don't understand how that could be. I didn't even think that refunds were an issue. Anyway, I had all these assumptions about refunds. Like if I'm refunding someone's money, the credit card company isn't charging me for it. He said, let's check that assumption. I gave him some research and I gave him some reports that he could go and research that with. And he just went up and down my spreadsheet, giving me feedback, giving me direction. I was like firing away emails at my account. What about this? Should we be doing that? Here's what he said. Boom. And then I said, you know what? I shouldn't be in this. Can I set you up with a call with our bookkeeper? Great. He's going to get on a call with the bookkeeper. I'm going to set you up. Anyway, here's the thing that I'm going to come back to here. TopTal has a lot of finance people. I never knew how to use them until now. Now I'm realizing it's not just if you want to help pricing your product. It's not just if you're creating spreadsheets for when you're trying to raise money. It's when you just need somebody with a finance experience to come and give you a fresh perspective on your business. I hired someone from TopTal. What I love about them is the top people don't need to even get paid to do a good job. They can't help it. He could not help but create these spreadsheet and Google Docs to send me before we started. That's what you want. Someone who's so good that they can't help being great for you. If you want to hire someone from finance and so many other areas of business from TopTal, the best of the best available for you to hire the way that I did, go to toptal.com/Mixergy. I'm not just doing this as a sponsorship. I'm telling you this as a resource for an entrepreneur, one entrepreneur to another. Go check them out at toptal.com/Mixergy. And of course, you're going to get this no risk trial period, which I'm still going through. So there's nothing to lose. Go check them out. Jake, I sometimes like go on these tears when I'm really like pumped about something.
Yeah, that's cool, man. I like it. And yeah, if you don't have a CFO or outsource CFO, you need to go get one. Like seriously, we didn't get an accountant or a CFO until I think it was about a month after the pivot. And they looked back at our previous stuff and was just like, this is a mess. Like
what did they discover? So
they discovered, just like you, we should have been an S Corp and not an LLC. I was getting nailed. I had no idea. Everybody, when you look online, they say like, oh, just register as an LLC. Don't worry about it. And then when you start making even a little bit of cash, it's like, oh, you're going to get taxed at like 40 or 50%. It's like my tax bill last year was ridiculous. And, you know, this year it's not going to be as bad. Like there's things that they're going to find that you never would even think about tracking, or especially when it comes to when you're an early stage company. And I'm sure you've done this too, making sure you're separating personal books from business books. And separating like owner expenses from business expenses and things like that, we just weren't doing that as well as we should have.
Because you were doing the books yourself.
Right. We were doing the books ourselves. I thought, well, it doesn't matter. I'll just put that down. Like I'm going to Walmart to buy stuff for the office and stuff for home. So who cares? It's like, no, it really matters to keep track of that stuff, because at the end of the year, all that stuff you'll be able to write off, and it adds up. Every little thing adds up.
Yeah. And you know what? If you're just starting, a bookkeeper is not that expensive and can actually help you. If you have someone with a little tax knowledge, they can actually save you money. And you're right. As the business evolves, this financial structure or the corporate structure could make sense to change. I actually asked him, I said, why were we even set up this way as this kind of LLC? And he said, truthfully, when you got started, you probably weren't. And it's true. I wasn't trying to make money with Mixergy. So it would have made sense to set it up the way you were. As the business grows, as revenue comes in, things change and it's worth looking over. That's really helpful. How'd you find your bookkeeper?
So in Charleston here, there's a accounting service, and they work with all the big tech companies in town and the small tech companies too. And I just acted around for some recommendations and saw their model. And it's funny, their model is almost exactly like what LaunchPeer's model is. They just do it for accounting. So it was like a perfect match, and husband and wife team that founded the company together. And so it was a great match for us, but yeah, it was a good fit.
I'm with you, by the way, I think that an individual bookkeeper is a waste. I like these bigger companies so that you have one point person, but you have backups with lots of other people there.
Right. And there's a lot of times our accountant's out of town or something, and I just have an emergency, like, oh, we just hired a new employee and I need to get them onboarded to our systems. Oh, well, if my accountant was out of town for a week, that wouldn't happen in the time that I needed it to. And I'm a very not last minute person, but you know, I want somebody there for me when I need them there for me. And so with a company like them, And I'm sure with TopTal, your finance guy, like you have people like backups that you can go to and get help from.
Well, TopTal doesn't do the bookkeeping for me. I also use a bookkeeping service, but you're right for the same reason. I think a lot of entrepreneurs think, how do I get a bookkeeper? And at some point internally, when you want to hire someone, it makes sense to have a bookkeeper. But until you're hiring your own person, I think it makes so much more sense to do a bookkeeping service. Like you said, you have backups, you have last minute things, they have people, multiple people to be there for you. I also think sometimes as entrepreneurs, we, are hesitant to send something to people. And if there's an individual like mom and pop, you feel bad. Why am I sending it to them now? I need it to be turned around by tomorrow. I don't want to feel that. I want to feel like there's a service. Right. It's on you guys. I'm hiring the team. If it's not done, I should be upset.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's why we picked that company too.
Okay. So you now have your model. It's all set up. You're ready to roll with your business. And now we have to think about how to do this right. Because if you don't do it right, you're going to lose money on all these startups who are, as you say, demanding, and they should be demanding.
Right.
So what's the structure that you set up in the beginning, and how did that structure evolve to allow you to service all these people in a systemized way?
So when we made that pivot, we were still four or five like actual people working on the business. Me and my wife full time, and then we had a couple people who were sort of drifting between half and full time based on how much money we had that month. And we were floating somewhere between $5,000 and $15,000 a month in revenue, only because it depended on projects. When you're an agency, you're very project dependent. So one month you have a project and the next month you don't have a new project and you just go back and forth. When we made that pivot, like you can see our books, like our growth curve in it. And we have an article on Medium about this. We went from like maybe $5,000 to $10,000 in revenue to, I think we ended 2016 with about $80,000 in October, $100,000 in November, and like $120,000 in December. And that just made our whole year. And we ended the year of 2016 with like $480,000 in revenue. So if you add those 3 months up, there wasn't a whole lot of revenue before that. And the year before, like I look at the yearly breakdowns when I want to feel good about myself and the business. 2015, we made like, you know, $15,000. 2016, we made $480,000. And this year we're on track to do about $1.5 million. So I think the thing that we put in place was the biggest differentiator was we got back to who our customer was. And so we started speaking directly to them, which meant I knew what podcast to go on. I knew to go on Mixergy. I knew to talk to guys like John Lee Dumas, and I knew what articles to write. I knew what lead magnets to write. Cause I mean, if you go back to the website example, what lead magnet am I going to use to capture government contractors, startups and healthcare IT? There's no lead magnet that's going to capture all three of those people. But if we're working with early stage entrepreneurs, I know that every one of them wants a list of 240 amazing tools to use to build their startup, right? Or today we have a bunch of other lead magnets on our site. And so really getting back to that messaging helped. I think the other thing that helped was the upfront pricing. When I go buy a car, I think the thing that people hate the most about it is that, sure, there's a price tag on the car, but you know you're going to have to deal with some sales guy that's going to be like, oh, you know, but you want this option and that option. It's going to cost more or less or all this stuff. And when you're an early stage founder, the last thing you want to do is schedule a call or a meeting with an agency that's going to end up telling you while you're sitting there, oh, we're just out of your price range. Like, you can't afford us. And we didn't want to do that to entrepreneurs. We'd much rather have our pricing on our website. The only people at that point who would schedule a call with us or a meeting with us are people who we knew could afford it, which saved us a lot of time on people who would want to call us and say, oh, can you work for equity? Which we still get sometimes, but it doesn't happen as often. And so when we put our pricing on our website, that's really what changed a lot of things. And since then, we put a lot of processes and stuff in place with the transparent pricing where we don't bill clients on deposits. So we don't say, oh, hey, Andrew, you want to buy a Honda Odyssey? You're going to have to pay $15,000 today and $15,000 when you're done with the car. It doesn't work that way. You pay like a really small deposit and then you pay payments over the course of a few years. For us, what we do is when a client comes to us, we say, okay, your project's going to take 300 hours. What's your burn rate? Okay, I can spend a couple thousand dollars a week, or I can spend $1,000 a week or a few hundred dollars a week. Like, okay, based on that, we're going to bill you every 2 weeks for the hours we worked the previous 2 weeks. And we're just going to keep working every 2 weeks at that burn rate until we're done with your project. And so we really let our clients kind of spread out the cost of building their startup over time instead of forcing them to make a decision today. And then with that, our clients can fire us every 2 weeks, which I think is probably the thing I love about what we do is that my team has to prove to our clients that we're good at what we do every 2 weeks, because since they're paying their bill every 2 weeks, if they're unhappy for any reason, they just say, you know what, guys, like, thanks for the 2 weeks of work. Thanks for the 40 hours you worked on my stuff, but I don't like the quality of the work, or I don't like the lack of transparency, or whatever it ends up being. And it gives them the freedom to go somewhere else, as opposed to if we charge a deposit, they'd kind of be locked in on whatever the project was that they were having us work on.
Okay. So I see, let me see if I understand the onboarding process. Brand new person comes to your site. Chances are they're not going to be ready to go and hire you right away.
Right.
But they will give you their email address in one of many different ways, maybe to get a lead magnet, maybe to just stay in touch, maybe to find out more, right? Then they get emails, which you guys drip out, as I understand it, using HubSpot.
Yep.
HubSpot. Yeah, they're all HubSpotted out is what I saw.
All HubSpotted out.
They manage your website, your email, your calendar for booking calls with someone. Okay, so they come in, they get these ongoing messages, they finally are ready to buy. They go to your website, launchpeer.com/development. Your next step with them is to go to the bottom and book a call.
Right.
Who is it that they'd be booking a call with?
John.
John. What does John do?
So John's our business development guy. So he handles all the initial phone screens with different clients. So he's basically, I guess you call it qualifying, but he's really, what he's doing is taking 30 minutes to learn what they need done and whether we can help them do that. Most of the time it's just really differentiating, like, do you want us to build something for equity, or do you want to actually pay us? And if you want to pay us, what is it that you're trying to get built? That way, when we have the second call with them, we can decide, okay, do we need to have an iOS developer on the phone? Do we need to have a web developer on the phone? Do we need to have our marketing team on the call? And so he's kind of doing that initial contact with them to find that stuff out. And he's an entrepreneur too. A lot of people on our team are entrepreneurs. They've all built startups before or are in the process of building their own startup, which I think also differentiates us a little bit. I hire people that are entrepreneurs first and their skill sets kind of secondary.
Okay. Why entrepreneurs?
Because when we're working with bootstrapped founders, and I learned this from the agency I was at before, if you're not an entrepreneur, you don't have an entrepreneur mindset. If a client says, hey, I want to build X, Y, and Z. If you're not an entrepreneur, your thought process when you work in an agency is great. Like, we can charge 300 hours of work for that. Like, let's do it. Well, if you're an entrepreneur, you're thinking, I want this entrepreneur to keep as much money as they can. So why don't we use this third party tool where we can only charge 50 hours to implement, and it'll, you know,
What's
we won't
make the third party tool that you guys can use to avoid development.
So we've had clients come to us who wanted us to build like a custom. This is one good example. Who wanted us to build a widget on their website that when they click on it, it captures an email, captures a name, captures a phone number, and then sends a PDF document to the customer, right? And then also integrates with their CRM, which I think they were using Zoho at the time. And, you know, we gave them an estimate. And then I realized after we gave the estimate and we were about to send it out, I think it was for like $10,000 or $15,000 or something. I said, hey, Rodney, and he's in town. Tree Lee is his startup. So, you know, you can use Lead Pages, sign up for their, I think it was $97 a month at that point. And they have Leadbox, which is their like pop-up tool where you can place a button.
And you guys didn't even set it up for them. You just said, look, I'm an entrepreneur, or I think like an entrepreneur. That's what John would have said. I think like an entrepreneur. I know this other tool. Just go use it. As an entrepreneur to another, I don't want to charge you for this. Go build.
Exactly. So we told him about that tool. He tweeted about us relentlessly about how we'd saved him like tens of thousands, because he'd gotten quotes from other shops too, but nobody told him that there's this third-party tool out there. Okay. He ended up coming back about a month later and had us build his website, do some design, because we saved him what he thought he was going to spend. And when you do that for someone, I think it builds a lot of trust and builds a relationship with them where, sure, maybe he wouldn't have worked with us, but he would have told his friends to work with us because he knew that he could trust our relationship with them and help them save money, whatever, you know, however we did that.
Okay. All right. So I see the onboarding. The marketing part doesn't blow my mind. Is there something that I'm missing that would blow my mind?
So the difference between our marketing and other places' marketing is that we focus on the idea of a sales funnel. And you kind of touched on this a little earlier, and ManyChat's a great way to do this. A lot of startup founders aren't really educated on like what a sales funnel is. Like, how do you build a pipeline to get new customers? Most of them make the mistake that I did when I was early on, which is, let me build a website, put a contact form on here, put a register now button on here, and just spend a ton of money on Facebook or Google Ads to get traffic there. And then that's kind of it. That's where they stop. For us, what we do is we build the lead magnet. We integrate the pop-up to their site. We figure out based on what kind of company it is, whether it's a mobile application or it's a B2B web application or it's a healthcare application. Where are those customers and what's going to appeal to them? Because when I look at marketing, I look at it like a bell curve. You have a bunch of people on the right-hand side who are going to buy right now. You found them at the right time. They have their credit card sitting next to the computer and they're ready to go. People all the way on the left-hand side that are never going to buy. They're just not your ideal customer. They just stumbled across you because their friend liked your page on Facebook or something. There's a bunch of people who are in the middle who are just question marks. Like, I don't know if I'm ready to buy. My credit card's not next to me. I'm using another solution right now. I have a contract that doesn't end for another 6 months or whatever. Our job as a marketing agency is to do whatever it takes to get the people in the middle to convert into actual customers. And so that's kind of what we do. We build that whole system for startups that we work with.
Tell me just one thing that makes the marketing automation more powerful than other people's I use marketing automation. We all do. What's right. One thing that you've learned that we can all take and build into our businesses?
So I think the one thing that I've learned is messaging is so much more important than people give it credit for. When you're looking at who your ideal customer is, a lot of startup founders make the mistake of, well, I don't want to be too specific with my messaging because then I'm going to alienate certain types of customers. And so what we do when we go in and we work with a new client is like, no, we should be alienating people. Like there should be some people who go to your website and say, this isn't for me. Like I don't need this. I'll never need this. I'm actually a little offended that like they're not trying to target somebody like me. And so we want to make sure that we alienate those people to get the ideal customer to actually click on it, which is what our website does. If you look at LaunchPeer's website, we say that we work with startups. There's going to be people who need development we could work with who work at companies like Verizon, which is a client of ours. We've worked with Verizon or some restaurant sites in town like Edmund's Oast, which is a really popular website in Charleston, which we've worked with. But some of the people at those companies are going to go to LaunchPeer and say, oh, well, I'm not going to fill out the contact form because they don't work with people like me. And that's totally fine. Like, that's not a problem. That's actually a good thing.
Okay. All right. I see it. It's lots of different ways in. Lots mm-hmm. of different nurturing. Actually, yep. It's not lots of different nurturing. It's one or two nurturing sequences of emails, right?
Right. So we usually do two sequences of nurturing emails. And we also have different ways to nurture, too. So we believe like there should be a lot of different touches. I think there was some study done somewhere. I don't know if it was that true or not, where it takes like an average of 8 touches with someone to actually get them to become a customer. So you can send some emails out, but they're not all going to get read. But at the same time, you can always nurture them with retargeting Facebook ads or retargeted Google ads, which we do too. So, Andrew, if you've been to our website, you're probably going to get retargeted now for a long time.
I have ad block on. I don't see
jobs. Oh, you're good then. You're good.
Let me go to Facebook. Okay, so what you're saying is it's not just the email that I get when I sign up.
Right.
It's nurturing via Facebook, nurturing online via Google. You also have something called the Academy. So I might sign up to learn from you guys, and you guys use Teachable. It's free.
Yep.
Teachable. So I might sign up and learn for free from you guys. If I give you my email address, you're using that also for retargeting. Okay. So I see now the marketing automation. Talk to me about the business part of it, because once you get me as a client, unless you've really systemized the way that you service me, it's going to cost you money. So what do you do? Blow my mind with the process.
So our process, what we do when we get a new client working with us is you're automatically integrated into your own private Slack channel. So in that Slack channel, you're with our entire team. So like, let's say Mixergy signed on as a client, it would have a Mixergy Slack channel and our project managers would be in there, our developers would be in there, our designers would be in there. And the communication is instant, which lowers our overhead cost. So instead of our project managers only being able to manage 2 or 3 projects at a time, which is what usually happens at other agencies, our project managers are able to manage 10 to 12 projects at a time, because we really encourage communication between the developers and the client. We don't
maybe we need to go back a step. What about the scope? What I found is that if you're really clear about what you're going to get done, it makes it easier for you to do it at the right price. So how do you narrow down the scope with people?
So we've accepted the fact that most clients we work with aren't going to really know what the scope is. So what we do when we first start working with them is we identify a very high level scope and say like, okay, you want a mobile application that's going to do X, Y, and Z. Very, very high level. once we start working with them every 2 weeks, we're not just billing a client. We're sitting down with them on a Monday and saying, look it, these are all the features that you want to get built. We're going to build features 1, 2, and 3. We're going to finish them during the 2 week period, sit down with you at the end of the 2 weeks and demo them to you. Because a client really can't understand what they want until they start seeing something getting built. And so our entire process is built on that transparency. So from day one, we have the application live so they, our clients can actually go and see it instead of us saying like, all right, Andrew, like we'll be back in 6 weeks and we'll show you whatever we've built.
So you take everything that they're looking to do and you come up with 1, 2 week a project that you could accomplish.
Yep.
You go out and you do it. Now, when you write this all down, their list of the ideal set of features, where does that go?
So we use Jira or Atlassian or whatever. We integrate all of that stuff in there, and we actually
That's a task management software that developers love.
Yeah, developers love it. We just moved to it. We used to use teamwork.com actually, but it didn't have all the reporting capabilities we needed. And so we invite our clients into there too. So clients can literally, they could see every minute of every hour of who's working on their project, what they're working on,
so
what
in
status it's in.
The full scope list?
Everything. Everything's
and then
in there.
You as a team will help the guest or someone on your team. Who on your team will work with the client to come up with the first 2 week sprint?
So our project manager and our lead developer on that project will work with the client.
And they get on a call with them every week?
Every week. Every week you get on a call with us.
Specific time, every week you get on a call, yep. And you're very clear over this next 2 weeks we're going to achieve. It's a sprint, right? You guys use Scrum?
Right. Yep, exactly.
Okay. Scrum, so every 2 weeks, you know what you guys are going to get done. It goes into your project management software where the client can watch what happens around it. And then your development team, who's on the development team? Is it local people or is it remote people or is it contractors?
So it's all local people. So we're headquartered in Charleston, South Carolina. We do have a couple remote employees, like one in Georgia, one in Colorado, but everyone's here stateside. What we do is, you know, everyone being here in the office, but all of our clients are dispersed all over the country. We have clients in Alabama, California, New York, Seattle. And so we really have a big mixture of all of our, you know, what type of clients we have, which forces us to act like a remote team, which is why we use Slack. And we don't just use Slack for communications. We integrate Jira with Slack. We integrate Trello with Slack. We integrate our design tools with Slack. Like, basically, anytime a developer changes a line of code, a project manager updates a task.
It goes every into time the Slack channel that your client Slack has? Channel.
Yep, exactly.
What do Trello? Why do you use Trello if you also use...
So we use Trello mostly for the marketing task management because Jira is great for development task management, but not so great for like marketing task management.
Okay, and then I see. So now the team knows what they need to get done. The client knows how many hours it's expected to take and how much the client's going to pay per hour.
Exactly. And they know what is being charged. Because when we say a task is going to take 10 hours, they can see the progress of our time tracking towards that task during the 2 weeks. So if we track 7 hours, 42 minutes, and 30 seconds, they're only going to get billed for 7 hours, 42 minutes, and 30 seconds.
What happens if it takes longer than you guys expect?
If it takes 12 hours, 13 minutes, and 22 seconds, they get charged for 13 hours, 14 minutes.
So you're not telling them here's exactly how many hours it's going to take us over the next 2 weeks to hit this milestone. It's more like we expected it's going to take this many hours. You can watch us. And if it takes a little bit longer, you have to pay more. If it takes a little bit less, you get to pay less. I see. Okay. All right. For the growth stuff, it all happens in Trello. So if I hire you guys to grow my email list, what happens in your Trello?
So our onboarding process is very similar for all of our clients. So we get access to your email marketing software. We get access to your, if you have any landing page software already, we use that. If not, we use ClickFunnels or some other landing page software like LeadPages. When we start working with the client, our biggest thing is a goal. So I'll give you an example. There's a brand out of California called 4Athletics. They do crowdfunded athletic apparel. They came to us and said, guys, we're spending $5,000 a month on Facebook ads and our customer acquisition cost is hovering around $40 to $45, which is a lot, but their products are a little on the higher side, about $60 to $70 per product. Their whole goal was we want to lower the customer acquisition cost down to mid-20s. And so when I worked with them, our marketing team said, look, I don't care what we do. Like, I don't care if we focus mostly on Facebook ads or Google ads, or if we focus on one lead magnet or five lead magnets. At the end of the day, I want to see measurable decreases in customer acquisition costs. And so when we work with clients on the marketing side, it's less about, oh, what's the specific scope? Like, how many posts are you going to have on Facebook this week, or how many tweets
are you going to tweet? So what's your system then for creating the – sorry, it's not all that. You were going to say what it is instead.
Yeah. So what we do instead is we take measurable steps to achieve that goal. So for that client, that meant focusing mostly on the Facebook ads because that's what was driving the most traffic. That's where they wanted to lower the customer acquisition cost, and they were spending the most money. So during the first month of working with them, and we wrote a case study about this, they went from $5,000 in ad spend to $4,000 in ad spend, went from a customer acquisition cost of $50 per customer to $13 per customer. And they went from, I think they tripled their revenue, and they were a Shopify store, which I love Shopify for e-commerce because you can actually see the analytics of it. So I was actually able to screenshot and post it in the Slack channel with the client and say, look, we tripled your revenue this month. But for that client, we took a Facebook ads approach. For another client we're working with called Snap, they're a B2B healthcare startup in town.
So how are you keeping Facebook track of whether you're hitting their goals or not? Is it a spreadsheet that then pulls data in from Facebook or what? How do you keep track of it all?
So for them, it was an e-commerce store. So we were able to print reports out from their e-commerce store.
I mean, you internally, if you're managing all this as a company, do you have a process for doing this? Or for each client, do you go in and individually look at their work?
Yeah. So for our marketing clients, we work on sprints too. So every 2 week sprint, we're not only for the development team, they're giving a report to the client of like, okay, here's what we were supposed to work on. Here's how many hours we worked and what we accomplished. The marketing team is doing the same thing, except for them, it's not how many hours we worked because the client's not getting charged hourly. What they want to know is what's a report of the progress we're making towards our goal. So if we're running Facebook ads, we're going to go and say, hey, we started running these 5 ads. This is the customer acquisition cost for these ads. And based on what your goal is, we're meeting that goal by like 220% or so. And so we're giving them constant updates as well. And they're also in our Slack channel. So every time we do anything with them, we communicate with them too.
I'm trying to systemize our company again. Mm-hmm. I think our systems got a little stale, so I'm redoing it. My goal is to bring everything into one dashboard that's in a Google Sheet. And I know that sounds very amateur, but I want one place to see it all, and everything can feed into Google Sheet. And that's why I was wondering what you were doing. And it sounds like...
So one thing that we set up, and this might actually work really well for you, is for every client, we have a Gecko board. I don't know if you've used Gecko board before.
That's a, but basically a dashboard creator.
A dashboard creator, right. And so we have a different dashboard for every client. And so we identify what our clients' key KPIs are, which for development, they're always the same. For marketing, they're different because it depends on, do you want just user acquisition or do you want revenue growth or whatever? And we create dashboards based on that. The cool thing about it is it does integrate with Google Drive. So if you want to create a spreadsheet for something that's not automatically tracked, you can create a spreadsheet for it. And for you, you can have your VA update the spreadsheet and it tracks that. We do that internally too. So our biggest KPI for me is how many sales calls is my business development guy getting every month. That lets me know if I'm doing a good job at lead generation, which means are our lead magnets working? Are we going out to the right customers? Are we doing the right things we need to do to get more people on the phone with our sales guy?
Okay. Yeah, I like this. Looking through Gecko, right? Geckoboard.com.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm giving out websites. The website for anyone who wants to check out your site, Jake, it is launchpeer.com, launchpeer.com. Tell them you heard him on Mixergy, even though I get no percentage. if you see that his website, his personal site is down, please let him know that jakecare.com is down. If it's up, here's what you could do. You could actually, I was researching this as we were talking, you could hit escape on any Squarespace site to get to their dashboard. The reason it didn't work on Squarespace.com is you can also disable that feature, and they must have disabled it on their own personal site. Yeah.
Yes, you probably did.
It's a pretty interesting little feature of Squarespace. And finally, if you are looking for a collection of designs, I really urge you guys to go check out designcrowd.com. They just do such phenomenal work, low price, and the collection of designs are so different that you can find something that fits you. And frankly, if you don't, or even if you do and you want a little bit of adjustment, just let them know. Their designers will adjust. You pick and pay for only the design that you like. designcrowd.com/mixergy for that big discount. And if you want to hire what I did, someone who's going to help you with your finances, whether it's figuring out prices, or maybe it's cohort analysis, or maybe it's creating spreadsheets for your investors, whatever it is, go check them out at toptal.com/mixergy. That's TopTal, T-O-P-T-A-L. tal.com/MixerG. And finally, we're working on the audio and the video in these interviews. Please give us feedback. The team is looking for some feedback. If you hate it, if you love it, if you're noticing something that could be improved or something that has been improved, contact at MixerG.com and the whole team will get to look at how we're doing with our interviews. Jake, thanks for being on here.
Yeah, of course. It was great, Andrew. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks. Bye, everyone.